Hey everyone, it's a new episode of Articulate Warbling with Zach Ferguson and Laura. So yes, hey, brand new episode and brand new stuff. This episode was recorded back in January, but because of the backlog, Zach sent me so much stuff in such a short period of time. It was insane. I still have a backlog of stuff. So we're going to get some more stuff out as soon as possible. And here we go with this one. And I think you're going to like it. So here we go. And sorry about the travelogue. That one I just mixed up titles. I named everything travelogue and didn't remember which one I named which. So yeah. So here we go with this. I hope you enjoy it. I enjoyed editing it. And here it is.
So, took about an hour and 40 minutes. Laura got there before me, finishing it. I was two chapters behind. Sensational. Might go into a full-fledged review of it tomorrow. It's sinking a little bit. It is now 12:30 a.m. the 27th of January. Fucking hell, January's come to a close quickly, isn't it?
No, everybody's complaining about how slow it's gone, and I'm sitting there like, fastest bloody January I've ever had.
Same. David Almond, if you haven't read him, and don't. Please, I hate it when people are like, oh, it's a kid's book.
No, it's not.
Oh, it's for children.
I will go into the full reasons tomorrow when we do a proper review of it, why it's not a kid's book, because, wow.
But the truth of the matter is, books shouldn't have an age limit, and that's the sign and testament to a very strong, very good writer. That they don't fall into cliches, stereotypes. They don't. They don't really pigeonhole themselves. And David Almond's stories, they work on a multi-layered level of things. And this book just makes you attenuate to certain emotions about grief, about your connectivity of family. It's a very deep, sensational, masterful, prosaic, poetic read. That's got so much going on, considering it's only a 170-page book. But I'm just rounding off with what's on mind in this moment. But there's so much to go into that we'll do on the morrow. So, within a few, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You need to introduce it first.
Well, there's already an introduction. I've done that already.
All right then.
But welcome back to the book club. The book in question was Skellig by David
Almond.
David Almond.
Forget the L, it's Almond, as if it's AR.
David Almond.
Correct.
And this is like take two, because I read the synopsis and I fucked it. So Laura's going to do it on my behalf. Garage.
Michael steps into the crumbling garage. What is this thing beneath the spider's webs and dead flies? A human being or a strange kind of beast never seen before? The only person Michael can confide in is Nina. Together they carry the creature into the light and Michael's world changes forever.
Oh, and it changes your life forever too. Not in like some philosophical sense or big, great, life-changing way.
I don't know, I found it quite life-changing. I found it quite life-affirming.
Did you read it? Yeah, it's life-affirming. Did you read it and was there moments in it that you recognised from when you first read it, or was it like a totally new experience again?
Well, because I studied it at school, it was very much reading it and then going, oh yes, I remember that quote, because I think I may have written about it about 30 million times.
Mm. It's surprising that you came away from doing that and then you still like the book, because usually when you're forced to study a book, you end up fucking loathing it.
Yeah, but you know when you were at school and you used to, like, have different people reading different sections, and it used to be the slowest, most painful book reading of your life?
Yeah, it takes everything out of it, because everyone has a different cadence, a different tone, a different way of reading. One moment could be, like, the most comedic thing, and then your teacher's reading it like, Gloria slipped on a banana skin.
Well, that's what I mean. Like, when you look at the first... I remember the person that read the first couple of sentences.
Yeah, and not chapters. Did they not even have the capabilities to read 2-page fucking chapters?
No. It'd be a chapter, a lesson. And judging by the 46 chapters, it took us 46 lessons. But when you look at the, I just remember this one girl, and she wasn't the most confident of readers, no. Right? And I just remember her starting with, "I found him in the garage on a Sunday afternoon."
Stephen Hawkins is her father.
And I just remember just thinking, like, this is going to be the slowest fucking book I have ever read in my life.
That's why I never engaged in school with doing that, the reading together, because it just takes something from it, and it's just dull.
It was the day after we moved into Falconer Road.
Yeah.
And do you know what the funniest thing is you still have people...
They didn't teach you to, like...
See, when I was reading, I'd find, like, you know, when you find a when somebody's talking, so it says, "We shoved our heads in at the doorway with him. You have to see it with your mind's eye," he said. Like, I get really...
Yeah, you play it.
Yeah, I do play it. And when I hear somebody talking, I'm actually hearing them talk. And I think sometimes it's helpful, because I've seen the film version of this, and it's always helpful to connect... I think once you've read the book, to connect the characters, and then you're kind of like, yeah, is that who I imagined? Isn't it who
was
I imagined?
Was Mina a part of the film?
Yeah, but different. She was bitchier. She was more...
It wasn't as mean, because just by the trailer, it didn't look like she had any meaningful connection with Skellig in question.
Well, she did and she didn't, but she was kind of this... I mean, I know she was a little bit pretentious anyway, but she was, like, extra pretentious in the film. Mm. So it was all kind of like, "I'm Mina!" And it's just like, oh, I haven't got time for people like that. But then when you go back to the book, and I read the book first time at school, watched the film at school, and then I've obviously read the book again last night, and it's different. And it's different in accordance to what's happened in your life. Like, I read this in year 7, so I would have been, like, 12.
Mm.
And I always remember, I'm sure they say, like, bollocks in it somewhere. Did they say bollocks?
Yeah, bollocks.
Towards the end, is his dad saying bollocks, or no, his mate saying bollocks. And I remember going, "Miss, can I say that word?"
It was like bollocks to that, yeah.
Because at 12, you're not allowed to say shit.
Well, the thing is, it says bollocks, but then there's this huge, like, argument between a father and son, Michael, where he's like, "Don't say bloody at me!" And he's like, "Bloody, bloody, bloody!" And it's like, what do you fucking say? You just throw out bollocks at the end of the book.
But for me, personally, and I'm glad we're doing this podcast now rather than last night, because I think I honestly would have cried last night. But for me, when I read it at 12, it had no meaning.
Mm-mm.
It was just a book I read at school. And now, looking at it and reading it again and experiencing it again as if it was for the first time, it connects with me on a deeper level, because it's around, you know when he's talking about feeling his sister's heartbeat, and right towards the end, his sister's heartbeat stops.
And he assumes she died.
And it's like a gap in him has just opened up. And that, for me, resonates after I lost my dad, because it is very much like losing a part of you. So I actually had tears in my eyes as I was reading that, because it is just, it's a beautiful
never
analogy.
Made me cry. I was near to tears with some moments in this book.
Exactly. But yeah, it's one that I've read when I was younger, and it is considered to be a children's book. And it says at the front, the Times have said, "There really is nobody quite like Armand writing in children's or adults fiction today." But the thing is I don't see it necessarily as a wholly children's book.
I don't think...
It's appropriate for children.
Oh yeah, this is the thing, like Philip Pullman, like... who did his Dark Materials, who's wrote a lot of children's novels that varies from ages, adult, prepubescent, even kids' novels. But there is that distinct... Is that nice? Tasting your mug?
It dripped down the side. I had to lick it off before it dried.
And it was like a... though I don't agree with his machinations and his philosophies and writing, his standpoint was... Yeah, I am a children's novelist, but that shouldn't detract an adult base from not wanting to read me.
Mm.
He says, "I like the notion that, you know, stories are there to illuminate, to educate, and to, you know, just pass on the baton to grow and expand. And it's a growth, it's a wealth of mythologies." And he's a guy who's very into the Brothers Grimm's tale, mythology himself. But the real reality and the overall summation that I'm coming to is he's saying, if it's compelling enough for a child? Why is it not compelling enough for an adult? We need for the publishers to be able to market this and label this and say, you can read this between this and that. But the strongest piece of literature is the one that you hand down from child to child to niece, nephew, nan, granddad. A book that you can pick up and go, I read this to my son and I loved it. I think you should read it. So the thing is,
I think Skellig is that.
Exactly.
That,
exactly that kind of it's book. Compelling enough that it's not just on the merits of being a kid's book. You can pick the book up and go, fuck, you know, that's good for a children's book. But that detracts it in a way, because there are certain novelists and writers who write specifically for an age range and demographic, and you have the cliche, you have the reined inness. Here, the content isn't so much reined in. Of course, it could be a little bit more sweary, it could be a little bit more, but David captures that sceptred part of their youth and childhood where we're not going out misbehaving. It's that point of where that discovery of self, and it captures the growing of that family dynamics. But because of it's compelling, it's relatable, it's real. And the thing is, that some people have come away. I've been doing a little bit of research saying it's all metaphor. Yes, it could be read as that. But I like to think it's just this beautiful tale of angels, of resonance, of nature, and of fauna, and and through that there's a lot of density that a child will not appreciate. But you may come to it later going, I read that as a child, I'm reading this as an adult, and it's a completely different, as you said, experience from when I read it. But that shows the strength of the piece of fiction. He may have set out to write a children's book, but he's written something that is, it bypasses a generational thing, and it can be, it's just there for everyone.
It's kind of like, you know how Disney movies make their movies, and an adult can watch it and find something really funny because it's like a hidden innuendo.
Always, yeah, yeah.
But the kids are like, mummy, what are you laughing at? Yeah. And
don't laugh at that!
Exactly.
I don't like you laughing at that, mummy! And you're like, dip joke.
Exactly. But that, for me, is what David Almond has done with Skellig. In the sense of, as a child, you read it with such innocence, such fantastical.
You just see it as a tramp who's in your garage, yeah, and he's got wings.
Well, no, I never saw it as that. I knew he was a bird from a very, well, as soon as I started reading it, I was like, it's a bird. It's
I just
a bird,
assumed he was an angel, and then I thought everything was ruined when it like signifies he's an owl with an image of an owl at the back, and I'm like, why ruin it for me?
Well, that's the thing, but when I read that, I was like, it's just this fantastical kind of fairy tale, effectively, and actually, as an adult, you read it and you read it with a.
It's allegorical, but also it is a thing. I don't think that David's written it and he's like, it's all allegory, it's all in their head, because it isn't.
No. But I mean, it connects, sort of going back to the whole children's fiction thing. I read a couple of books recently by Cecilia Ahern, who is my favourite author, and she wrote a couple of books that were for young teenagers. And I
young
read,
adults.
Well, yeah, whatever.
Part of the Hunger Games demographic.
Yeah, kind of, but a little bit more innocent, but not. And I read it and I thought, oh, I didn't really realise. It wasn't until I got to the back and it was like, do you want to read the next young adult thingy-mabob? And I'm like, no. And I read them and I...
Because this book is so good.
Exactly. But it's like, well, maybe I don't want to read it
puts
now
you off,
doesn't it?
Teenagers. It does.
But actually, reading that story, I thought it was fantastic. I thought it was a fantastic.
Well, people look at you oddly in the book section, like, what the fuck are you doing here? So in the past, I've pulled my phone out, and I'm not lying, I pretend to be on the phone to a relative going, do you think...
What time, John? What was your friend Johnny want?
Yeah, do you think, what does Griffin like? David Walliam book? Sure. No, I don't care. Now, since I've settled in my role as a writer myself, I don't give a fuck.
See, I've never really cared, because I just walk in and it's like, look, if you seriously are going to ask me, then I'll say I'm going to read it for myself. If not, you can look and you can judge. But as far as I'm concerned, as far as you're concerned, I might have a niece or a nephew or a little brother.
You'll read, and also it picks up on this, which I love.
Reading confidence labels.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That demographic of... Is that, sweetheart, is that all you're capable of? Because it's got that sticker on it. No, I just want to fucking read this book!
And Mina said that, didn't she? She said, so if people with higher ability want to read a book with a low ability badge on it, does that mean they can't because they're bored and they would be considered to be stupid? Or, you know, that's not the exact quote, but it's along those lines.
No, but it's along those lines.
And it frustrates me because she's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. You can only read books of your ability. Why the fuck would I want to do that? I will read whatever book I want to read. I have read nearly three books since the beginning of this year, which is really fucking good for me, by the way. Skellig was the second, and I'm halfway through my third. The first one I read was an adult, and I mean like in your 70s or 80s book. It was hard, man, but not because my reading age is blah blah blah, purely because the story was so complex. You needed to have, like, 50 years of experience of life before you read it.
Yeah, the thing is, I find this always when I start a book. I, no matter, even if it's a place of familiarity or it's new, I struggle to start a book. Uh-huh. And I have to read the first two chapters at least twice because I need to familiarise myself with this new person's prose, the structure, the way they're telling the story. Even if it's the most simplistic thing, I kind of have to inundate myself with it. That's why I was behind with you, because I said to you I had to read the first two chapters twice because I was getting all tongue-tied because it is written in a specific stylistic way. And even
it's
though
very different from what you used to.
Yeah,
read.
And, like, you know, I'm used to, like, puzzle pieces. Yeah. I'm used to very dense, hyperbolic, out there, big worded stuff. And the simplicity and the purity of this, and the simplicity adds the subtlety, it adds the poeticism. And it was a little bit, it was powerful in its reservedness. So people may claim that this book, oh, it's an easy read. No, it fucking ain't. It took me like a bit, about like 20 minutes to get my head around what he was telling me, where we were coming from. And that's still the thing. It completely demolishes that whole demographic labelling thing again. But it's always easy to put labels on.
Well, the thing is,
and that's
book,
what I loved about Mina, because she personified everything that I believe about the education system, the interrelationship with art and reading and nature.
I think the thing is, this book is appropriate for children purely because the chapters are a maximum of 3 pages long. And it is written in a simple manner. I'm not saying it's a simple story necessarily.
No.
But it's written in a simple manner. You've got short, punchy sentences. You know, the first two sentences, I found him in the garage on a Sunday afternoon. Full stop. Next sentence. It was the day after we moved into Falconer Road. Full stop. Next sentence. Every sentence is probably 2 or 3 lines long,
and
if
it's
that.
It's not filled up with details.
No, but you get enough detail from it. That's what I love, is the fact that some
when
authors,
when the detail is offered, it's more impactful.
Yeah, but some authors, they will sit and they will write, and they will write about how pink and flowery and whatever this woman's blouse is, and they can fill 3 pages worth, and I'm like, fucking hell, woman, what is your problem with this woman's blouse? Whereas with this, like, you just, I mean, it's literally, you have set the scene in one sentence. I found him in
rarity.
The garage on a Sunday afternoon.
It's a rarity.
And instantly, you're like, okay, it's Sunday, you found him in the garage. Who's him?
But exactly, it's that mystique. But the problem with children's novelists now, let me make an example as well. If this was read by a writer now, I found him in the garage on a Sunday afternoon. I was scared, I was sweaty. What do I do? It was a day after we moved into Falconer Road. I don't like Falconer Road. I don't know how to feel about it. The winter was ending. I love the winter. I love snowballs. Mum had said we'd be moving just in time for the spring. I don't like the spring. Crunchy leaves. Nobody else was there. Just me. Others were inside the house with Dr. Death. Dr. Death because of...
Yeah, there's so much... And I've never been... So English was always my best subject at school. English is still very much one of my top things that I'm commended for at work. And the thing is that even to this day, I cannot understand the different... the nouns and the verbs and the adjectives and the pronouns.
I'm a writer and I don't understand all that shit.
Subordinate clauses, I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. And we've played a quiz game about grammar and we're going, don't know. I know what sounds good and what doesn't sound good, and I know what's right and what's wrong, mostly. But I don't get that. Which one of these words is the adverb? I'm like, not a fucking clue, mate, but I can tell you if that sentence sounds good or
not. Yeah.
And that's the thing that I loved about this book, is the fact that throughout, no matter what...
It's not condescending.
No,
nor
it's
is
not.
It underestimating the reader.
So, under chapter 38, which is a good 40 pages from the end, it literally says... Plants dared to send out buds and shoots. Life dared to come back. I don't need the greens of the buds and the yellows of the blossom and the this and the that. That punchy two lines was enough for me to go, spring's coming.
Mm.
And I can see it.
Yeah.
And I don't need you to tell me that the buds are all really tightly closed in and a daffodil might pop out in the next 2 weeks. I don't need you to give me all of that la-di-da bullshit.
Well, that's the thing. That's why I'm a writer of a hyperbolic fashion. But because I do it for a stylistic, aesthetical thing and satirise it, my whole relationship with it enables me to read something like this and better appreciate it. The subtlety is, when he gets into that garage... and there's the cobwebs, the blue bottles, the spider's webs. It's so impactful, it's so visionary, it's so well visualised in the subtlety. And there's a repetition that is always encouraged in books and novels that is encouraged because it implants that vision. Though it repeats the same details, it's in a different fashion, it's in a different relationship, but also because of the subtlety of the prose and the writing, this repetition is necessary to give the world its feel, its dirtiness, and even though the character, there's a purity, there's that alabaster type skin, there's the stone like cement aesthetic, he's still filthy and dirty. But the thing is, the subtlety of that, instead of going to the minute details, just by certain repetition, there's a synergy and a cyclical way of it, and it sticks with the reader. Also, throughout the book, we kept sneezing. We kept having, like, symptomatic, like, reactions to it.
And I think the thing is, for me, is that... I can't find the bit that I'm looking for, which is a little bit annoying.
That's why I was going to say, let's take this stuff out of my bookmark up and put it in pieces that hit us.
So, it's not the example I was looking for, but an example about Ernie's toilet. So, if you haven't read the book, basically, there's a guy that died in the house before they moved in, and he was unable to get upstairs to go to the toilet. So, they plumbed a toilet in downstairs in the living room for him so that he could do everything downstairs and he didn't have
to... Just a partition of plywood propped up. Which is... I see the... and that's the thing, the subtlety of that. You go... Well, we don't live with anyone, so why the fuck? Because of even the vanity of just being at a pod yourself, a lonely man. Don't need to go into that detail, which a writer will tell you. They will siphon off all this information. You just know it's the implication, and it's from that relatability and that lived-in world. This is the thing I love about David's work. It's lived-in. The common threads and themes are of grief, specifically subjected about losing sisters, family members, fathers, and... It comes from a place of hurt, and when a book comes from a place of emotion, hurt, there's a depth, and it's very hard not to feel it.
Yeah, absolutely. I've still lost the place that I wanted. Anyway, so my point is there's this toilet, and they take the toilet out of the living room.
Into the wilderness.
And put it into the wilderness of the back garden. And, yeah, okay, they describe the toilet a little bit. I mean, they could really, you know, he could really go into detail here about how disgusting the toilet was. And I can, you know, but I think that's the best thing, is reading this book, even at a young age, when they describe this toilet in the corner, I'm not seeing a flush, white, beautiful porcelain toilet. I'm seeing one of those horrible public toilet, brown around the edges, don't want to know what it is thing. And David didn't say a word. Not a single word, but you imagine it. And
you
this
fill
is the
in
thing.
The gaps.
It encourages imagination, more creativity. And
because of the surrounding minor descripts of the detritus, the mess, the dust, the musk, the almost, it is a rickety, worn down home. You apply that to the toilet in question and everything else in and around it.
But you don't need all of that explanation to, you know, to
because
to
I
see
think that,
that
there's a great inundation with children's literature now where they give too much, they offer too much. What is it called? It's like the Greek chorus. they have to even before it hits they don't give room, and this is a thing that I've been talking about in my recent releases, Interiors, especially with literature. You're not given room or space to occupy with your own interpretations or thought. Everything has to be done to the minutiae, so it doesn't allow, you know, a place of standing and understanding and a positioning of relatability, because they're saying this is how it is, blah, 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 blah. But then even when
everything has to be done for you,
exactly, and I keep losing the word what it is, but it's everything is told to you. It's not
and
discovered.
And this is the thing going on to kind of society, which goes back to some of our other podcasts,
which haven't been put out yet. DB, TikTok, TikTok.
But it's about everything being instantaneous. You have to be told everything in order to imagine. Now, there is a part of this book that is literally 13 pages in, so it's really, really, really early. And it says that this teacher, who knows the parents of little Michael, she takes a fruit gum out of her pocket and held it to me. A fruit gum. It was what she gave the new kids when they were sad or something. Now, in a new book, with newer children's authors, you would have, she takes a blackcurrant fruit gum out of her pocket. It tastes like Ribena.
You forgot, she unravelled the plastic.
Oh, God, yeah.
The familial crunch, crunch, crunch. And it's like, yeah, the prose is nice, but you're being too self-indulgent here.
And this is the thing, is everything's got to be, you've got to explain everything to the ninth degree. And it's just, it's frustrating.
And that's the thing with, like, I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's the thing about, I've been describing it as going through, like, the point is, it's not a kid's book, it's not just for kids. It is a children's book. It is for children.
Yeah.
And that type of inundation is suitable for an adult book. It's not for a children's book. But that's the beauty of our children's book, that clarity and that vision and that space that allows you to also go along and fill in the gaps. When an adult comes to a book like this, it is refreshing and it is new because of that beautiful clarity, but also that room for you to imagine, and also the subtlety.
It does make you imagine, because when she passes the fruit gum to him, I'm like, oh, I wonder what flavour it was. And I know what flavour I'd want it to be. And I think that's the best thing, because in my head I'm like, it was orange, because I love orange flavoured fruit gums.
Mm.
So in my head, I've gone, that was an orange one. Other people might not have imagined what flavour it was at all. But it gave me that space to go, that was an orange fruit gum and it tasted really nice. I filled
that's
in my
funny.
Own.
My
filled in my own gaps.
Yeah, that's funny, because you do. And even if you, and it's not even expected of you, because I didn't fill in the gaps in that sense. I veered more to the emotional side of things. I wallowed in the offerings because of that connectivity and the resonance of what it means to her to get it. He's aware of it because he mentions it.
You see, you can tell me I'm just all about sugar. You're like, emotions. I'm like, fruit gum!
And he's embarrassed by it, because later on, she does the same thing of comfort when it comes to his sister, who isn't named by this point in the book, which really infuriated me. But the thing was, it was part of the story.
I loved it, because it gives you that mystery all throughout. What's her name?
It ended it on a beautiful note, though, when it's finally, her name is, you know, Joy. And if you're listening to this, don't feel it's ruined it for you, because the thing with these types of books, they've been around so long, and even if you don't know of them, there's still so much in it contained. Even as short as it is, there's so much contained within it that nothing can be ruined, even if you knew the whole story
and that's
from
the
beginning
thing,
to end, because
as I said,
the not just the simplicity but the power of the prose and the writing.
And that's it, you know, as I said, I read this when I was 12. I've read this again almost exactly 10 years later, and actually I'm sitting here thinking it's better now.
Mm.
Even though I knew that her name, the baby's name was Joy.
Mm.
And I knew all of that, and I remember the 27 and 53, his Chinese order, and I remember all of those things, but reading
Nectar
it
of the gods.
Reading that again didn't ruin it for me.
No, because there's an infrastructure around that leads to it and gives extra resonance, right? Warp, how they distort, how they change, how they alter. So many layers that can be read and that are there, so fucking evidential within the structure and the whole heart of the book. It's there, and it's so resonant, and it's so clear in its vision and its fantasy and its narrative. But there's so much more. There's allegory, there's symbology, the allusions to William Blake. I absolutely love, because of course Almond loves William Blake, as does Philip Pullman. A lot of people from their era of writing have an appreciation for William Blake, but I love it that in a children's book they are able to introduce someone such as William Blake to them.
However, that then meant that our English teacher went, "Let's study William Blake," and we were all like,
At that point you're like, but now at this point you're like, that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, well at the time it wasn't.
The man who sees angels, tormented, haunted,
but
then comforted by them.
What I think is good about, well, it's great about this book again is, you know, going back to your kind of symbolic point, is when we get introduced to Whisper the Cat, and it starts, we don't know anything about the cat, and all of a sudden they're outside this condemned house, aren't they?
Yeah.
And he says, "Something brushed against my leg. I looked down and saw a cat that had come in through the gate with us." "Whisper," said Mina, and she grinned. Now, I like that, because that Whisper is the name of the cat. But Whisper is also the kind of overall symbol of this book. It's about being quiet and whispering and tiptoeing around. We do a lot of tiptoeing through this book. Michael does a lot of tiptoeing. You know, I tiptoed here, I tiptoed there, and you know, again, we didn't need much explanation, because most other writers nowadays would be like, "Oh, I tiptoed on my big toe and it hurt."
Well, the thing is, because they've discovered, and we've not really mentioned the character of Skellig yet, they've discovered who initially could be a danger, and this great evil mystery is a dirty, ragged man in ill-fitting suit and clothes. And it's that nature of keeping a secret, but not a secret because it's taboo or because of what the parents might think. It's a question of his own sanity at the most fervid point, and that's why he introduces Mina, more out of the sanctity of wanting to be reassured he's not going nuts. And then there's this, is it trifecta? No, wrong word. It's just this beautiful three-way bonding relationship that goes, that then becomes quite spiritual and transcendental. This man who's waiting there, waiting to be calcified, just to die, just to solidify, to crumble away. And it goes into the point of birds, nature,
but also that fantastical side of things. That fantasy, that that fairy tale element. I think with this book, it's just wonderful from beginning to end. It really is, and it's very difficult to, you know, I could talk all bloody day about it, because it's just fantastic, and it's just so symbolic of so many things in life. And I think the best thing about it is, because it is an older book, and it's, you know, David Almond is getting on a little bit in life now. He hasn't introduced Mina because he has to have a woman in his book.
No.
And do you know what I love the most is the fact that we don't know what colour Michael is, or his dad, or his mum. We know what colour Mina is because he says that she's pale. But black people could look pale. But my point is the fact that you've got this older book that doesn't need to meet certain criteria. We don't need to look at it and go, we've got one boy, we need one girl, we've got a mum, a dad, a baby, we've got a weirdo, we've got and you know, the thing is nowadays it'll be like, oh well, we've got a fatherless family, now we need a motherless family, and everything has to be, it has to be
boardroom mandated to hit certain societal standards. It's not societal standards, it's imagined fucking rules,
and
as usual.
It's just fiction.
Yeah.
That's all it is. It's just a book. A fantastically beautiful, beautifully written book that doesn't need to fit in with society.
It's the standard set for no reason, just to hit a criteria, because there's so many fucking boo-boos and snowflakes. Yes, I said it. Snowflakes.
And, I mean, we do touch on the fact that Mina lost her dad, but it's not a big thing, is it, really? Oh, my dad died before I was born. And that's it. We don't go into the mourning, and the loss and the grief of her mum and blah, blah, blah. It's literally, as in her mum's grief. It's just like, yeah, my dad died before I was born. And that's it. And it's just like,
the book hasn't got room for that. It's just about them.
You don't need room for it. You don't need that to be discussed. Okay, so we've basically been introduced to this new family. Dad's not around because he died before Mina was born. Great, move on.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened.
And you understand where more of her sympathy lies in the understanding of death and grief. But she isn't a morbid character. She's so soulful and positive. And
she's very wise, very clever, very clever girl.
And the thing is, the beautiful introduction of her was when she sees Skellig. Michael is distancing. He's more intrigued by the almost the desolation of this character. And she sees something that needs, and that's why he brought her along. And he's crying, he's tearing up, this stranger going, I don't know what's going to move him, I don't know what's going to motivate him, I don't know what to do. And it's just a kindness and a softness that he hasn't felt. She's just met him, and within a few pages and a few moments of the book, she kisses him on the cheek, a reassurance that you are seen, you are heard, and we are going to help you. Mm. And that was so powerful to me.
And also now
people go, that's disgusting! Dirty paedophile, owl man, angel! Well, she kissed him. That's disgusting! You can't have that in a children's book! Children shouldn't go out because I'll start kissing tramps! Oh, fuck off.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But that shows when this was written, before we had all of that. And I think that's why it resonates with me so much, is because we have moved on so much in society, and I don't think we need any of that, but that's where we are, and there's nothing fuck all we can do about it.
No.
But you can still enjoy a book that was written just for the pure love of writing, and for fiction, and a story that David Almond clearly had and that he wanted to get out there.
Well, as I said, it's that common, like the books that I've got at mine that he did with Dave McKean, The Savages, Slog's Dad, Joe Quinn's Poltergeist. I think you should read them because they really fit in stylistically, not just stylistically, but emotionally with the content of that. And you can see the tendrils spreading out, that it's a lot of hurt that he has. There's a lot of, and you see that hurt will not go away. He's like in his 70s or late 60s now, and that hurt has never been displaced. It's never been lost. It is going to change. And he mentions with characters, and a lot of characters in his work say, I've changed in myself. Am I ever going to find myself again? And the thing is, no, you're not, but you need to still continue, and you need to accept who you are now and evolve as that person. And a lot of people have been critical of his work, going, oh, it's the same old thing. Yeah, but he doesn't do it in the same ways. He constructs
but
it of its
so
own originality.
So many writers do have the same theme. I know Cecilia Ahern, except for the two that I said about reading, they're all based in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a death.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always there are always certain things that are the same.
Yeah.
Very, very different stories, beautifully written stories in my opinion, but it's still always an island,
yeah.
It's still always a death,
yeah.
There's still always a family,
but don't question
whatever.
Because then it's a natural, you see it as a thematic, you see it as a current theme, but it doesn't inundate and become the be all end all to her overall
books. I think there's
books.
Only one book that I've gone, come on now, love, we're doing the same thing here. But other than that, you know, and she's got loads of books out. Other than that, they're all very different in different ways. And that's the thing, is there will be an overall theme, because it's about what's affected us in life.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same as us doing these podcasts.
Well, it's the same with my books.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, we do these podcasts, we always come back to labels and societal issues, because that is the theme of life.
Yeah.
And that is the thing, the things that have affected us in life. Yeah. So for me and you, societal issues bother us, labels bother us. For David Almond, clearly death is a big thing in his life, because he's lost, you know, some really important people. And actually, I think if I found myself to write anything, which, you know, it would not be worth reading, it would be around,
because it comes from a place of purpose and it comes from a place of experience.
And that's the thing, is it would be around death most probably,
yeah.
Because in the last sort of, you know, 3 or 4 years, that's all I've unfortunately experienced. And death. It's an amazing thing, really, because you always get told, oh, it gets easier.
No.
It's easier to manage, and eventually you forget about it and you get over it. And you don't. You really don't. And
well, that's some rehearsed spiel from a narrow-minded unemotional dickhead who hasn't experienced it themselves.
And this is the thing, so many people haven't experienced it, and it's actually not until you lose a parent do you really realise it. Because I've lost family members.
Me too.
usually the older ones. And I'd lost these family members, and I was just like, yeah, okay.
Because it's anticipated, because their time had come, and that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think this is the thing.
And that's how it's decompartmentalised, whereas when your parents have that limelight on them, it's there, it's meant to be there, because you're at a certain age where you're like, I still need you there in that light, and then when that light goes off for one of them...
you don't realise that.
It's taken from you.
And that goes back to the you know, the... a really old saying about how...
I come from a different POV because I haven't got a father figure, and if he died, I wouldn't feel anything about it.
I think you would. You'd be surprised how much you feel about these things.
I don't think I'll mourn him.
It's not about mourning. It's about a lot of my...
I'll probably be angry and go, why didn't you try harder, you selfish cunt?
A lot of my issues were based around... what if I'd have said this? What if I'd have said that? I haven't got answers for certain things that I wanted to have answers for. And then it gets into the morning, if that's what you're going to do.
Yeah. And now he's fucking throwing glasses at me in your bedroom and fucking jumping on my back.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But it's, yeah, it really is that... that place of experience... really is. It's that place of knowing, not knowing. And I think that's the purity and the strength up on this novel, is because it's born from experience. And you know greater than anyone else, really, because you've suffered the worst grief that I think anyone can, losing a parent.
Yeah. And you don't know what you've lost until you've lost it. And that's an age-old saying now. You don't realise what you've lost.
There's a reason behind why it's such an age-old adage. Adage, because it's too fucking true.
Mm. It is, absolutely. And it's not easy.
And this thing also with Skellig, I liked. He was so ready to go. He was ready for death. Death was waiting in the wings for him. But... in a weird way, it wasn't. He kind of assigned his own death warrant. And not a lot of it is spoken about Skellig, because he doesn't need to have that history. His story begins and ends with these characters. And I think that mystery is necessary.
Mm. Yeah, it is.
And it's more pivotal. And when it turns out that his mother said, I had a dream, this tatty man is leaning over my child and I wanted to scream at him. And he picks her up and she's touching his face and smiling. And there's this ethereal ghost-like wings. When he comes in contact with people that he either loves or has the reciprocal love and emotion and connectivity, they have these wings, and that bit where they go in a circle and they're spinning and spinning, and Michael's saying, oh, I want to pull away from this. And they're like, no, stay with it. You need to stay with this. And it's a very spiritual awakening. And he kept referring to them as my angels. You are my angels. And though Michael never said it, and it's never told to you, Skellig is his and her angel. Much more for Michael. Whereas Mina was more of a... I think Mina's involvement is far greater to Skellig than Michael's relationship. People may disagree with that. Michael found him, did give him sustenance, but their friendship was born from almost a banter of, oh, for fuck's sake, kid. Just get me my takeaway. And also, going back to that narrative theme of not telling you much, the doctor, he said, Ernie Myers, did he have visions? Yeah, but he was dying and he was old. He was like, yeah, but did he see things? He said he saw a lot of things when he was here, but he was dying. And then that's enough to know that Ernie was aware of Skellig's existence. Mm. Skellig was aware of him, but he said he looked through me most of the time because he was ill. But then you're in that place of maybe he wasn't looking through you, maybe he saw you. And he felt that he was his angel looking over him, or he was death waiting for him. It's so much.
There's so many symbolic.
So much. So many avenues to go down. And Skellig isn't even the central character. Mm. His appearances are very fleeting. And it is about the disintegration, the decimation of not just soul but physical. This book is an analogous of death, grief, and reawakening and rediscovery. And I think it's a masterpiece. I really do. I don't think I've read a book that's touched me here, and here.
Did it touch your shoulder, did it?
Yeah, because the wings are sprouting out from my shoulder blades. Oh, it's beautiful.
I think the thing that I love the most as well is...
And I thank you, because I saw Skellig on your bookshelf.
Oh, well. I think the thing I love the most as well is the fact that right towards the end, when the mum comes home with baby, Mina comes in and gives her a picture that she's drawn of Skellig. And, you know, David Armand could have literally written another book's worth of this book just on... that picture, because
how, where, why
this mum has seen Skellig, and this picture that Mina has drawn,
assuming it's all in her head,
exactly, this picture that Mina has drawn is exactly the same image of what she saw with her daughter, and literally you could have written another like 40 pages worth of book
talking about it, sitting down discussing it, rationalising it. No,
but what does she do?
Also the thing of, Michael, did you tell Mina about this? No, none of that.
No, exactly, and that's the thing, that could have been, you know, could have been so easy to do. Let's have a look to see. She unrolled a picture of Skellig with his wings rising from his back and a tender smile on his white face. Mum caught her breath. She stared at me and she stared at Mina. For a moment, I thought she was going to ask us something. Then she simply smiled at both of us. And that literally is just giving me goosebumps. You don't need to go into any further detail. Mum just smiled. And that is just beautiful. And that's like the last frigging page,
and
second to last page.
The connotation as well. She says, and I don't know if it's a religious thing. I think it's a religious family, but it's not weighed in on that. She says, "Have you been praying for your sister?" Whereas he hasn't been praying for his sister, but he's been keeping watch over his sister with his heart, with his soul. And she keeps saying, "Have you been praying for her?" And he never directly goes, "Yes, I've been praying with my hands to the Lord, Mother." But there is that spiritualism, that's religioso. And that's that tender moment where it's like, I'm just accepting this. My baby girl's home because of whatever external force. And whatever these kids know about it, they just know I appreciate it.
And that's the thing, is the day Michael goes to school is the day that the baby goes back into hospital and she's really poorly.
And this is when he's like all
and
happy.
And he turns around and he says, it's because I stopped thinking about her.
Mm.
So actually, no, he's not praying. He's feeling from the very pit of his being, the very bottom of his soul, he's feeling, he's being with her, he's loving her. And the day that he goes back to school and goes, la la la, this is all great, everything goes wrong. And he says in the book, he says, it's because I stopped thinking about her.
Yeah.
And that is so sad.
Mm.
Not because I didn't pray last night, but because I stopped thinking about her, I stopped feeling it. And that it's just beautiful.
It's one of the beautiful stories, and the parents don't question ever about, and there's no jealousy there, which I love. It's not that cliched story as I'm jealous of the baby. When it got into the heated argument, Michael phrases something where it can be misconstrued as that. It's like, you're just thinking about her, meaning you're not thinking about how this is weighing on me.
Yeah.
And I think in the books, it portrays the blinkeredness of parents of to the extent of the emotion that weighs in on children as well. And it isn't until after that little mini argument with his dad, and they said, we both threw ourselves at each other, I'm like, what, fighting? And they just hug and kiss and just have a cuddle, and it weighs in on you in that moment, that simplistic scene, a moment that, yes, his dad is realising, and maybe I shouldn't try and protect him by mollycoddling him and distracting him.
And I think, yeah, that's something that sat with me from a young age and also sits with me more so now, is that when they're, you know, they do, they argue, and they really, really go at each other, and then the dad just turns around, he gets up, and he strokes Michael's face, and he says, I love you. And that for me is something that I've never experienced.
No, me neither.
And it's fucking...
Not from a father.
So they're arguing, they're yelling at each other, go to bloody school, he yelled, get out of my bloody sight. Then he just reaches across and grabbed me to him. "I love you," he whispered. "I love you." And that was where my tears started last night, because it's not a lot of families have that.
No. Oh, baby. Don't start crying.
I try not to.
It's that place of, no matter the arguments are heated, no matter how instantaneous it is, it's just like, it's an apology. It's like, "I know I've done fucking wrong, but just know it comes from a place of love, and I know where you are with this." And this is the first, because there's no illusions that the parents are aware that it's weighing on him. A lot of the time, they just think it's bothering him at school, and it's actually bothering him at the pit of his being, because he has that connection with his sister that they don't know about, and they not even contemplate. The mother assumes he's gone into the bedroom to ask for something, and he's only checking up on his little sister. Yeah. And the sister is an allegory for so many things, and also in those auspices and allusions to chicks. Fragility, bones, the delicacy, and the sink. And there was another line that says, "Babies, they're strugglers and survivors." Mm. And it's like, that's true. And with a new baby comes just a lot of fear. There's not a definite quote, but it is. And it's not just fear for the parents. And I think it captures that from the children. And again, it's from a perspective and place of understanding and experience with David himself. You can feel it. Mm. You can feel that emotion. You can almost feel the tears, you know, streak through these pieces and pages.
I think the most concerning thing, which is still to do with the book, is that when I was at school and I read this, they asked us to write how David Armand could have made this a better book.
Oh, fuck off. And what did the teacher come up with?
Well, the teacher never comes up with anything, does she?
What did the students come up with?
Well, the thing is you have to write something, otherwise you get in trouble, don't you? And I remember writing, he always says he said, she said, and there were no, you know, when you use different, like, answered and replied and yelled and this and that. And I'm thinking about it now, and I'm thinking, like, shit. I just pulled this man apart, and it didn't need pulling apart, but I pulled it apart because it was made necessary to do so. And that hasn't given me an opinion on the book. I've made my opinion on my book since reading it a second time.
Well, it's the thing of academia. It indoctrinates you with a horrible imagined rule.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So
to summarise,
best book ever.
5 stars. I think it's up there as one of my favourite books.
Absolutely.
I'm very lucky that I have a lot of his other works, because I'm one of those people, if I'm interested in the author, even before I've actually read anything, I buy a whole load of their books. And it started because I saw your book, and I was like, I've always wanted to read David. But because that cover upstairs of one of the first prints, that cover is, it doesn't scream children's novel, and that's what appealed to me as well. And that's why I don't really much like this new cover, but then I realised, no, I do, because it actually shows Skellig in his tattered
suit. I don't like that.
No.
I want to experience the book in itself without the...
Well, yeah, that is true as well.
Because you're told the story, like, you don't even have to... If you look at the cover, you know what's coming. So, you know when he's experiencing the lumps under his jacket and on his shoulder blades? If you just go back to the cover, you know it's wings.
And he finally like needs to release them, yeah. That is a good point as well.
But, so I feel that ruins it, but that's mine.
But then, what was I saying? Anyway, beautiful covers. And I brought the book specifically because I wanted those covers. And then they've come and they're reissued and they have these new very telling you what it is, where it is type things. But I just, I like kind of the beauty. Also, you can see, look, the straining and then the unleashing of the wings on that cover. But anyway, it appealed to me. I brought all the works and I'm very happy that I did. And I recommend anyone seek out David Almond.
Almond.
David Almond. 5 stars from me. One of my favourite books, and I've got a few more to read. But anyway, ladies, gentlemen, pigs, sheep, some of you may call me an idiot. I consider myself a teacher. Anyway, thank you for joining us for a special book club review. What is the next book that we're going to book club?
Oh, I don't know.
Is there anything that you thought, we should read that together?
I mean, I think it would be funny, I don't know about you guys, to make Zach read the most disgustingly romantic novel ever.
I won't finish it.
But we'll think about it.
Okie dokie. Well, it's goodbye.
It's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from...
Laters.
Bye, guys. Keep well. Keep safe.
Read Skellig.
Read Skellig. Stroke those books. Smell those books. And also, I have a new book out. Interiors for... Well, it's Interiors for...
Then, a question mark.
And then there's a question mark on the cover. It's prose, it's imagery, and in the description in... this is basically nothing. It's just an experiment. There is something. $3.99. Available on Amazon, Wordery, some other third-chain bookstores who earn money off the back of my fucking releases!
And can I just say, don't forget... to visit Zach's new website,
Sweat Drenched Press.
www.sweatdrenchedpress.com. Follow us on
Twitter.
Facebook and Twitter and YouTube. And
also, that's the thing. Also, I want YouTube to be a space. If you're an experimental artist and you've got pieces that you would like featured on YouTube, send them along. Also, submissions are now open for the Experimenti chapbook series. I'm very looking forward to seeing what you have. I want you to join this community. I want it to be all encompassing. I want fellow artists, creators. I want it to be a place where we're just a community.
And it's all legit because I did it.
Yep. Well, this is a good thing by having Laura as admin.
Hang on.
Co-head.
Co-director and head of admin, thank you very much.
Because she knows the nitty-gritty stuff of how to keep this... she keeps the cogs and pistons well oiled. She's the one who is the real, you know, the administrative boss lady of this endeavour. And I'm just the guy who reads the books and inevitably edit them and put them out.
Well, that's your bit. My bit's the keeping hold of everything else. But as far as that's concerned, submissions through to... sweatdrenchedpress@outlook.com. Mm-hmm. Inquiries.
Inquiries.
For sweatdrenchedpress@outlook.com. It's all on the website. It's all on Facebook. It's all on Twitter. It's everywhere. Go for it.
I'm looking forward to seeing your subs and meeting you true infant taliblers. See you next time. Bye.
Thanks again, everyone, for listening to Articulate Warbling with Zach Ferguson and Laura. Recorded, Sweat Drenched Press, Brighton, England. Me, it's recorded and edited at Badger's Drift Studios in Portland, Oregon. Go to sweatdrenchedpress.com to find out more about what Zach's doing. Go to pgttcm.com. Go to the show notes to find out what's going on here. I'll have a link to all of Zach's stuff and just click on Zach Articulate Warbling on the website, and you'll find it right away. All right, thanks again so much, and more than likely, sooner than later, new episode coming up of Articulate Warbling. You can find it anywhere you find podcasts. Look for it on Stitcher, look for it on Spotify, look for it on Apple, look for it on whatever. You'll find it. Or look for it at pgttcm.com, or look for Black Clock Audio Tales, because I always host this show forever. All right. Thank you.